if you think the ground that I will cover is basically the same ground that Jayati covered last night, but the space of which my discussion is a different space. Her space was the impact of the crisis and the kinds of the policies that would be impacted. But my space is the arena in which the policies can be designed, right? So these are the different parts of where the policies can be designed. This happens to be the six chapters of the Monterrey Consensus, the financing for development chapters. But I'm just using it to organize. If you remember, Jayati had a slide in which she talked about all the different parts where the crisis would hit, right? And this is only about all the different policy spaces, which would be affected by the crisis. So one is domestic resources, right? And external private finance, she talked about that too. Trade, official development assistance, external debt, and systemic resources. So what I want to do is just to go through this and talk about, based on the title, right, where you can mobilize resources in a sense and how resources can be mobilized in the midst of the crisis. And first of all, of course, in each one of them, I'll talk about the impact of the crisis on the resource, but I won't spend a lot of time on that because we did a lot of that discussion last night too, right? As you will see, and I don't know how I will try to go through the whole thing. The agenda is very vast in terms of the policy changes that would be required in each of these areas, and I also think that the progress would be mainly in the national arena. That means in each country addressing its own crisis, dealing with its foreign creditors, dealing with the IMF, dealing with its own domestic constituencies, where the changes in policies can be probably most possible. Though there are open spaces now in the international arena, including what Jayati discussed last night, that the neoliberal agenda is quite incredible these days, right? And the fact that, and we'll talk about this too, that the export markets for big developing countries are not there anymore. The United States is not an important export market anymore. There is the national-international space, which I will tend to have a lot of discussion about, like in the Doha trade negotiations, the reforms of the Bretton Woods institutions, the reforms of the international system in terms of regulation, coordination, and coherence. But the last bullet is all about the fact that none of these changes in the international system is going to be done by design or by plan, unless there's a very big event, right, in which suddenly the world leaders come together and they call another Bretton Woods meeting and they decide to do a redesign of the whole system. It will be done by unconscious, uncoordinated acts, right, and the changes will happen by default and by de facto, by countries, for example, stopping to pay their debt, right, and all that stuff. So those are the kinds of changes that will happen, and then the kinds of insights that, the kinds of institutions that will arise from these makeshift adjustments is what is going to probably happen in the future, right? So we can design nicely, but things will happen in a very haphazard, unplanned way. I mean, this is my guess, right? I would rather have it in a planned way, right? But it's probably not going to happen that way. Okay, I joined the UN almost 3 years ago, and it turned out I was the holder of the global imbalance graph in the world. These are the global imbalances, right? What? And I'm supposed to be finishing an updated report, which meant that we just added this part of the graph, right? And in the United Nations, too, because of the politics, we're not allowed to add transition economies to developing countries, because transition economies are legally not developing countries, right? So actually, I mean, the transition economies, which is that graph, have the same pattern, right? It makes this thing worse. This is the thing that Jayati was talking about last night, right? At an increasing level, developing countries and transition economies as a group have been funding the developing countries through their trade surpluses and the accumulation of reserves, right? So if you look at the number, for example, in the last in the last year, in 2008, developing countries as a group, right, funded the financing requirements of developed countries by $800 billion, right? And this has been increasing every year since that time. So now this is reversed because the export surpluses of the developing countries have disappeared, right? And that's, in a sense, the blessing in reverse, right? Whereas, first of all, this kind of pattern is unsustainable, right? You cannot have the poor people financing the consumption of the rich, which is basically what this is, right? Theoretically, capital should flow from the savings, from the capital surplus countries where capital is abundant to capital scarce countries, the developing countries. But this is a very different pattern. And this is part of the run-up to the crisis that actually happened, right? The developing countries are actually funding the expansion of the financial sectors of the developed countries. And as I said in my previous lecture, it was not as if the developed countries use it very efficiently, right? It turned out the cars in the U.S. did not become any better. They ended up being kept in treasury bills. They ended up providing liquidity. And then the financial system had to find a way to relend them to something. And in the end, they figured out, first they tried to relend it to the dot-com, right? The dot-com was that as long as you have an idea about a project, we will lend you money, right? Some web page that might be attractive. That didn't work out. That actually went down the drain. Then they figured out you could do it in the housing sector, right? Which is a very old sector. And that's a kind of self-propelling system because as you keep on lending and people keep on buying houses, the asset prices go up, right? And as long as this is a collateralized market, you can lend more and more and more. So that's how this was intermediated. The money that the developing countries sent to the U.S. were not put into increased production. They were put into increased financial intermediation and speculation. But this is now reversed, okay? And that's this is reversed because of what we now have a crisis. So I'm now going to go to the six topics that I promised to do. One is domestic resources. What are domestic resources? Tax revenues, the domestic financial system, tariffs and taxes. So what has happened is that, what are the sources? One is, I have a little, social levy, domestic money, because of what Randy Ray's discussion. Money, right? So we had already a discussion about what you might be able to do with money, which is the, in a sense, from the levy point of view, is the claim on real resources that the government will insist on putting up. The other source is trade and tax revenues, right? One of the things that you can do within this crisis is to raise tariffs within the bound tariffs of WTO, right? The thing that is happening is that countries are suffering, as Jayati pointed out last night, decreased tax and tariff revenues because trade has been declining, incomes have been declining. So trade and tariff tax revenues have been declining among developing country governments. So one of the things that countries might consider is to raise tariffs within the bound tariffs. They can also figure out ways of raising tariffs on capital and on luxury goods, right? So why would it make sense at least at this time to raise taxes on capital? Well, the capital is not investing anyway. They're not employing anybody. So you can tax assets, and there's almost no impact on real activity if you do it that way. The other thing that's part of domestic resources, international tax cooperation. In April, the G20 pointed to some countries as being uncooperative tax jurisdictions. The G20 is very afraid of all the tax money that is going to the Cayman Islands. Actually, the biggest uncooperative tax jurisdictions is the UK and the United States, right? I mean, if you're a Latin American, you come to the US, you can open a savings account, and they will not withhold any taxes on your... They will not report to the IRS any taxes on your interest income as long as you declare that you're a foreign resident. So this is why, you come to the U.S., you open a savings account, as long as you declare you're a foreign resident, nobody will know that you have a tax, that you have an asset, you have a deposit in the United States, right? So this is there is an estimate that 500 billion a year are lost by developing countries through tax evasion. You know, if you look at all the illegal flows that are happening around the world, one-third of those illegal flows are due to the drug trade and due to the money laundering, right? Drug trade, money laundering, and terrorism. You know, terrorism is a very famous thing internationally because the United States is worried about funds being pushed around because of terrorism. But two-thirds is because of tax evasion, right? Two-thirds of the money is lost to tax evasion, among them by transfer pricing. Okay, there's an estimate, for example, that in the United States, 12% of the tax of customs transactions are improperly recorded or improperly. I'm trying to say, you know, you have to state what you're importing or exporting, right? A lot of transfer pricing, aside from just within the multinational corporations, is undertaken by underpricing exports and overpricing imports. Right? So quite a lot of that in the U.S. is 12%, which is very strange because the United States has an open capital account. So why would somebody try to overprice, for example, their imports when they have an open capital account? U.S. citizens can decide which currency they want to do. The reason why they're doing it is because of tax evasion, right? So a lot of money could be actually, and this is something that even the G20 recognized, can actually be raised by increasing international tax cooperation. Things like automatic exchange of information, cooperation in the collection of tax debts, etc., right? And there's some discussion in the international circles about this. The third one is remittances. Jayati talked about this. They have not fallen as much as had been expected, but they will probably fall this year, right? They haven't fallen in 2008. 2008 probably drought us between 5 and 8%, but this year they probably fall by around 7%. And finally, for domestic resources, the most important losses in domestic resources have to do with the ability of countries to impose capital controls. The idea always is that any country that tries to raise taxes on its citizens, right, or even increase its money supply, would begin to lose resources because of the removal of assets abroad, right? The IMF, and I mean, I'm trying to explain why these bullet points are there, right? The IMF has continued to insist that countries that are under its program not impose capital controls. Okay, the only country that was able to impose capital controls was Iceland, among all of those who are in the new program. And the reason why I have the second bullet is to say, part of the responsibility, the heavy responsibility that the IMF feels is that the viability of the financial sector in developed countries will depend on whether those who they had lent to abroad will be able to continue to service their obligations to the financial countries, to their mature countries. External private finance is composed of portfolio and foreign direct investment, right? And Jayati talked about this also last night. There is a portfolio reversal. Financial companies in mature economies have to recapitalize themselves, so they have been bringing back a lot of money. That means capital flows have reversed. Foreign direct investment have fallen, and this because foreign direct investment is very cyclical, right? It's not the kind of thing that any respectable developing country would like to rely on. It's very cyclical, and now that the cycle has gone down, it has actually gone down to these numbers, probably almost nothing in this year. But the other thing that's happening is that in the rich countries, there is what I call an anti-competitive rescue of multinationals. We know that, for example, the General Motors was rescued, a non-financial firm, but they're also rescuing Citibank and all of these other, the governments of the developed countries, right, are rescuing their own multinationals, which is anti-competitive because this would have been an opportunity for developing countries to buy out their, if you were a Korean, you will know this very well, for developing countries to buy out their firms, but they're protecting them by providing them resources to survive. And finally, in this particular case, there's going to be an increasing problem with cross-border bankruptcies. That means there are corporations that have liabilities abroad in which there is no mechanism for addressing this problem. Just to give you an example of a country that did it properly with respect to this one, Finland didn't allow its banks to buy these exotic financial instruments, right? So the Finnish banking sector is, you know, in a sounder shape than other banking sectors. The one of the most heavily badly damaged financial sector is the German one, because they bought a lot of what is called credit default swaps, right? And now that these companies have actually defaulted, nobody is in charge of paying off the default swap. So the exotic financial assets became toxic financial, that's what they call now toxic financial assets. There are no international mechanisms to deal with this. In effect, a country like Germany, in which many of its banks are holding a lot of these credit default swaps, have to figure out a way to raid taxpayers' money if they want to keep their own banking system going as before. Okay, so what to do with external private finance? Well, now is an opportunity to re-regulate. And among the things that I have in this chart is to say there should be a retreat from the General Agreement on Trade in Services, which is the WTO Trade in Services Agreement. This is a line from the G20 agreement in November, which says that each individual country should be the first line of defense against market instability. Well, if they are the first line of defense against market instability, they should have controls on imports of financial assets that are exotic, and they should have controls on the outflow of their resources, which causes market instability. A lot of the foreign exchange markets of developing countries are very small compared to the kinds of capital flows that are going on abroad, and they can be quickly undermined quantitatively, because their transactions in their own exchange markets are very small compared to the amount of money that can be mobilized by financial speculators. We have to rethink TRIMS, which is the trade-related investment measures, right? Which I think Mariama talked about. As I told you, this agenda is very, very broad, right? But this, in a sense, taking advantage of the fact that maybe the ideology has changed, right? Countries should now be able to say, well, you have to have domestic content if you want to continue to be invested in this country, right? Domestic content used to be part of what countries would require. Now you can justify it by saying we want to ration foreign exchange. We don't have enough foreign exchange for you to import what you need to produce. This is another thing. There's a lot of financial firms have not been required to register domestically, right? So actually they're not regulated by the domestic authorities. Actually, this is one of the suggestions of the Stiglitz Commission, the Commission of the President of the General Assembly, that all firms should be, all financial firms in any location should be regulated by the domestic regulations of that country. And finally, this is what they call the Financial Product Safety Regulation Proposal. China has been accused of exporting toxic toys, right? And the reason why they were accused of exporting toxic toys is because they had inadequate regulation over the use of chemicals and all that stuff. But actually, the United States is the biggest violator of exporting toxic assets, right? I mean, the assets that then end up in the portfolios of a lot of other financial firms. So the idea of this is to provide a way in which, you can say whether a financial product is safe or not for another investor to buy. And it's also investor protection, actually, right? And actually, at the international level, this is actually more a duty of the mature economies. But the mature economies want to do it on their own. I mean, in the negotiations in the UN, the US is always insisting that this should be national regulation without any foreigner looking into it, right? But the most heavily impacted, affected countries in this crisis have been those countries that are not mature economies, and they had no influence at all in determining whether a financial product was safe or not, right? So this is, again, another of those debates. I don't know where it will come out in, but there's a moral position that countries that would be badly affected should be part of the discussion, right? Okay, JRT has done this before, so I'm going to skip it. This is the third topic. Remember I said there were six topics, right? The third topic is international trade. The trade is collapsing. Developing countries are hurt more. Okay, and the impact is on employment, on public revenues, and foreign exchange earnings are falling, right? And when they fall, what happens? They have a harder time servicing their existing foreign debt, right? Or if they turn into deficit, they end up increasing their foreign debt, and they have a hard time importing inputs for the required domestic production. Okay, so among the things that have been discussed or are being discussed, I think later on I will quote a paragraph from the recent UN conference, an agreement among UN members, is our temporary surges on imports. This one is, we talked about this last night, that it's now unavoidable for a domestic demand wage-led growth, right? Unless you have all of these production facilities, if you're going to still rely on external demand, I think at least in the next 5 years, you know, there's always the hope among the powerful that they can restart the economy just like that. And actually, this happened during the Asian crisis. During the Asian crisis, there was such a big discussion. Am I going to? I hope I'm not running out of time. There was such a big discussion over the fact that the IMF had failed. IMF was not credible. That the international financial system was a shambles. That they thought that this would now be the occasion for thoroughgoing reform in the international system. It didn't happen. Why? Because they were able to restart growth with the dot-com lending, and then rescue it with the mortgage lending in the U.S. And this one is probably just a little bit of a pipe dream, but it will just logically it is there. The return of industrial policy, including in rich countries, if only to economize on public resources, on foreign exchange. If the U.S. government is going to bail out, is going to save General Motors, for example, right? It is choosing an industrial policy, right? It is saying, General Motors, a car company, we will rescue you because you are important. I mean, remember Obama always says he cannot imagine a United States without a car industry. That's industrial policy. 5 minutes. Okay. Okay. So this is now this is the fourth topic: official development assistance. Okay. Part of the problem here is I just want to say the most important thing I want to say here. The most important possibility at this point in time, official development assistance, is that a lot of ODA are attached to Bretton Woods programs, right? Many countries, particularly the Scandinavian countries, will not disburse ODA to you unless you have an existing PRGF, right? Which means that the IMF becomes the gatekeeper for a lot of these kinds of official development assistance. Now, what you have is actually a problem in which the shock is external, right? The shock is external. Therefore, policy conditionality of the Bretton Woods institutions does not make sense as the switch so that ODA can come in, right? And therefore, there should be a way in which you could end attaching BWI disbursements to a ODA disbursements to an existing Bretton Woods program. External debt. Okay, now this one, again, you know, fearless forecast. In 2 or 3 years, there's going to be an external debt problem all over the world unless they do what I mentioned a little earlier this morning about using SDRs to fund what developing countries need for crisis response, right? Developing countries have been drawing down reserves. Spreads have increased to their lending, even though interest rates are low. And all the countries are having a inability to roll over their debt, you know, the existing debt. Many countries used to roll over their debt in the private markets, but the private markets have shut down, right? Part of the problem is that there is inherited debt distress. Instead of HIPCs and LDCs, actually what happened in many of the HIPC programs, because they were IMF programs, they did not restart investment in those countries, right? They did not even restart investment in export-oriented industries, which the IMF likes, right? Because of the fact that the macroeconomic ceilings were set too low, right? And therefore, to the extent that many of these LDCs, many of the HPICs are basically least developed countries, require public sector participation in order to mobilize, in order to release private sector investment. Because public investment has been depressed for so long in these countries, private investment did not come up. This comes out in even in an IMF paper that came out in 2007. They themselves recognize that they have shut down public sector spending so much that private investment is not crowded in, right? Because if you don't have infrastructure, why would you risk setting up an export-oriented industry? That's the example. Or if you don't have reliable power, reliable electricity, why would you set up an export-oriented industry? Here, I don't have time to talk about the debt sustainability framework, but basically the debt sustainability framework of the IMF have been inconsistent with growth and development. So the proposals here, and including by UNCTAD, and this is, I think, this is also it would still be a UN proposal, is for the standstills on debt service and debt write-offs in this period. Otherwise, countries will be forced to borrow money, and a lot of them are actually quite vulnerable to a net debt crisis. Now, this is the last one. This is systemic resources problems with finance from multilateral banks. As I said, this, well, let me, because some people were not here this morning. The underlying problem with the kind of financing that the international community is offering to the developing countries in response to the crisis is that all of these resources are debt-creating. It creates debt, right? The second problem is that a lot of them, because they're close to the IMF, it includes a lot of policy conditionality. For something that for an external shock, there is nothing you can do about your policy when it's an external shock that's causing you to borrow money from abroad. And finally, as Smriti discussed this morning, a lot of IMF programs are still pro-cyclical. That means as the economy is going down, the IMF requires fiscal austerity and reduction in public expenditures. Okay, this one, it would have been nice to discuss it, but I'm running out of time. This is a set of paragraphs that came out of the UN document, which the U.S. There was a UN conference, June 24 to 26, right? And there was an outcome document. And in this document, there were some agreements about suggestions to the Bretton Woods institutions about what they should do, okay? And at the end of the document, so this was agreed, right? Because it's hard to explain this, but in negotiating situations, it's a social situation. People get tired, and eventually something gets approved, and it gets approved with a lot of wording that not all parties tend to agree with. After the document was agreed, the U.S. made a long speech, and among the things that they said, they wanted to state for the record the reservations on the following paragraphs. These are paragraph numbers in the document. And all of these paragraph numbers are about the United Nations giving instructions to the Bretton Woods institutions. Now you know, of course, that the G20 is always giving instructions. Before that, the G8 used to give instructions to the Bretton Woods institutions. But the United Nations cannot give instructions to the Bretton Woods institutions on the argument that these institutions have their own boards and they have their own governance structures, and therefore the United Nations should not have any power to tell them what to do, right? I've already talked about the coming debt crisis. This conditionality is a very nice, not a big thing that we can actually spend the whole 3 hours on. Even the G20 itself called for greater flexibility in terms of conditionality. I think Smriti talked about this, that the flexible credit line, which is a new credit line, for example, Mexico got $40 billion, for a few countries, is based on a preconditionality. If you qualify, you can get the money. Of course, the money is just a stock that is there, right, that the IMF is ready to lend to you if you get into a crisis. What's the point of this? Actually, it's a moral hazard for the international private sector, right? Because what happens is that it actually gives a license to raid IMF resources, right? Which Mexico, it's not just Mexico owns those IMF resources. All of us own those IMF resources. If the private sector wants to get out of Mexico, the IMF will be required to give those money to get let the private sector withdraw its all its capital out of Mexico. So it's moral hazard. I mean, it's a very bad, even in, just in terms of pure neoliberal economics, it's a very bad approach. The programs are still pro-cyclical. We talked about that. And then finally, on the Paris Club, the Paris Club is a committee of creditors, okay? And the committee of creditors decides what happens when you have when you run into a debt problem. Now, in normal inside a national jurisdiction, when somebody runs into a debt problem, it's a impartial judge that decides how you're going to divide up the losses from a failed loan process. But until now, the international system is based on this, where it's only the creditors that are consulted, right? And the way it is enforced is because they're enforced to an IMF World Bank programs that these countries undertake. There was only one country that escaped the Paris Club when it got into a problem, and you know which one it was? It was Iraq. You know, when Iraq happened, you know, there were existing debts that Iraq had to pay, right? And of course, you know what it is when a country has existing debt, it's zero, right? When countries have an existing debt, you have all of these bondholders going after you, and Iraq doesn't want to pay it back, right? So what the U.S. did, it went to the U.N. Security Council, got a U.N. Security Council resolution that says all those debts are canceled, right? So it's very good to be invaded because then the U.S. will go to the U.N. Security. Oh, they have to pay for that debt? Maybe there must have been some phrase there that exempted that part of it. Again, this is a whole set of discussion about the problems of global governance, the need for global regulation. Where do you regulate? Do you regulate nationally? The surveillance of the IMF and macroeconomic coordination, and the fact that the Bretton Woods system was set up before. Maybe I should stop and we can discuss. I'm not able to. Let me just go through the slides and just show what the slides are, right? So one is the regional efforts, right? The Africans actually have sort of said that they were eventually going to move towards a monetary union. I don't know why all of a sudden now they're not talking about it in the midst of the crisis. This is the kind of thing that functional finance could do, right? If you, first of all, what you could do is you can net out all your payments to each other, right? Which means you don't need as much dollars to clear your balances against each other. If you, first of all, start with the clearing union, but they've forgotten it. This is basically attempts to do it through in Latin America led by Bolivia. The Banco del Sur is not yet operational. I mean, it's operational in terms of incorporation, but it's not yet operational because they haven't gotten the contributions of countries into Banco del Sur. And the reason is, I have my own explanation, right? My explanation is the following, that last year, I think, they decided it would be one country, one vote in the board, okay? Now, of course, a country like Brazil has to put in more money than other countries, right? So Brazil doesn't want to do it without doing something. Of course, Brazil is not trying to change that one country, one vote. That was a decision by all countries, right? It's not trying to change that, but it's trying to find some way in which the loan processing could be such that Brazilians have more influence over how loans are actually granted by Banco del Sur. Banco del Sur is an attempt to set up a World Bank among the Latin American countries, right? A development bank, the way the World Bank is supposed to be among Latin American countries. Chiang Mai Initiative is a mutual support initiative, just like supposedly the IMF is, on balance of payments crisis for East Asia, for Asia, basically, for Asian countries. Okay, this is the paragraph that I told you about, that there is now some space internationally, maybe. It depends on each individual country taking advantage of the space to reimpose capital controls, right? And this is paragraph 15 of that UN conference. that says that countries that are facing acute and severe shortage of foreign reserves should not be denied the right to use legitimate trade defense measures, impose temporary capital restrictions, and seek to negotiate agreements on temporary debt standstills between debtors and creditors. This is another paragraph, actually, which the U.S. Stated its reservations on the outcome document. And as I said in the beginning, none of these changes are going to happen as if we are going to sit down together, we're going to argue, we're going to decide together, right? It's every individual country facing its own problem and deciding what to do about its the economic crisis that it's actually facing. Let me skip this about... the final thing is this proposal about using SDRs in response to the crisis. SDRs are special drawing rights. They're equivalent to world money, right? But the amount that is existing in the world system is very small. It's only $21 billion, right? And the attempt to double it has been stymied by the United States since the 1980s. One thing that what the world community can decide to do is to allocate SDRs to countries. What is the advantage of an SDR? It's non-conditional. That means it's an allocation that you can draw on if you want to, right? If you don't want to draw on this allocation, you don't have to, but there are no conditions on your using your special drawing rights. It's part of your reserves. It's part of the assignment of your reserves. So it's like the kind of money that we have on a national level, but it's an international money. And one of the proposals that was at stake at the UN conference was $100 billion to LDCs, $800 billion to other developing countries to be returned by them on recovery. The most important thing to say is that the world actually has a kind of money, which is the U.S. dollar, and the U.S. has an exorbitant privilege to be able to print world money, okay? Now, when an economy is growing, you don't want to print too much money if the economy is growing, but when an economy is growing, you can print money and there will be no impact on inflation on the value of the money that you're printing. Actually, the U.S. then has this kind of power, but they want, and what I say here is the global political constraints, that the U.S. does not want to increase the supply of SDRs around the world, right? And the reason why they don't want to do that is it reduces their ability to use their money printing power to run deficits, to carry out wars, right? And actually to control the nature of trade and commerce around the world. We had a little discussion here that we can return today about how this has always been part of a hegemonic global system. One of the things that this one is saying is that actually there is what is called the Triffin paradox. If the world economy is growing, the world economy needs increased liquidity. And what the Triffin paradox said is that if you're using the currency of one country to provide the liquidity, then in order for that liquidity to be provided, that country has to be running trade deficits, right? It has to be running trade deficits. And what has actually happened is that the United States, at least under the Bush administration, has brought this kind of deficit level to a global crisis level, right? It was actually uncontrollable. It would have been the self-control on the part of the U.S. that would have prevented such a crisis, but because there was not enough self-control, at least in the last decade or so, we now have a global crisis because of the kind of system that we have, the global reserve system that we have. I think that was the last one. Okay. These are all thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I have two questions. When you spoke about the ALBA is not exactly a traditional trade. It has another kind of agreement. And One is the question is, what is the real possibility of the sustainability that the ALBA? Because ALBA depends from the petroleum dollars from Venezuela. What is the real possibility of this agreement? And also, in South America, they speak about the opportunity to make the Banco del Sur. And they are also speaking about to create a new community money. And one of the things is what is the real opportunities, the possibilities, and the risk to take this decision in South America?
Based on the petroleum resources that Venezuela has said, right? And one of the most interesting things about the ALBA is that it uses a lot of barter trade, right? It allows barter trade to actually happen. So what's the advantage of barter trade? You don't need to go through the dollar, right? You don't need dollars. You don't need the supply of liquidity in order for this to happen. It's sustainable up to, I mean, according to the calculations I know, it's sustainable up to the current levels of crude oil that we have now. But if oil goes down below where it was, you know, right now the run-up in the oil prices started from around $25. If it goes down to $25, then this system will actually collapse because there are not enough resources that ALBA can provide. So, in a sense, what you have to think about here is the world system is so dependent on the US dollar as a way in which to clear the kinds of trade that it actually uses. Are there other ways to clear it, right? And you know that in effect, what the ALBA people are trying to think about implicitly when you talk to them, right, underneath, is a way in which you can create some kind of global reserve money. Not a reserve money by itself, but a way in which they can clear deposits first, right? They can net it out, and then it's only on the net amounts of the trade that then they have to find a way to finance it, right? But right now that's still far away. Right now they're still playing around with trying to use real goods to provide some way of escaping, right? Escaping the dependence of all countries on global liquidity. The Banco del Sur, I forgot the question. The Banco del Sur is a development bank. It's not, part of the problem with the Banco del Sur is they didn't know whether it would be an IMF or whether it would be a development bank. Right now it looks like the difference between a development bank and an IMF is this, that the IMF is like a clearing union, right? Theoretically, what happens is that countries build balances against each other based on their trade, and then you theoretically net it out. Of course, right now you don't need to do that, right? But you theoretically net it out, and the IMF stands behind all of the claims against all of the other countries as an institution. That's what a currency exchange system is, right? A development bank is a bank in which contributors put in money, they turn around and lend money for development projects. For a long time, the people who were discussing Banco del Sur didn't know whether it was a development bank or an IMF, because, as I said, right, in the case of the discussion on ALBA, they really wanted to get out of the idea was to get out of the Bretton Woods system. You're from Ecuador, right? So what is the problem with Ecuador now? If Ecuador imports too much compared to its exports, right, what happens is the dollar flows out. Now, even for your domestic transactions, you don't have enough money to use it because you're using the U.S. dollar, right? And you're not allowed to print your own dollars to carry out your own domestic transactions. This is the same kind of thing that the Chavez, et cetera, were trying to solve, right? Trying to get out of the international payment system so that they don't become dependent on it and don't build up the kind of debt problems that they had. But now it looks like the Banco del Sur is not going to be that kind of a system where you economize on using foreign exchange, but it's actually a development bank for development projects. And it's not yet in operation because they have...
Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. I just have a question. What's the relation between Alba and houses of Alba, Alba houses? Because which are very questioned in Peru by political reasons.
I don't know enough about the houses of Alba. So, yeah, I can't answer the question. I just haven't followed the... Yeah.
Hello? Yeah? They receive financing from Venezuela also. Uh-huh. Yeah. And they are contrary to the policy of the government of Peru, so they try to help the opposition. Huh? Mm-hmm. So that's I don't know if there is a relation. Mm.
I don't know. Actually, I don't know about this one, but at least I know in the United States, and they have stopped this. The Venezuelan government is providing subsidized fuel oil to poor citizens of the United States, right? So this is it's not a bank, but they're in the United States. In the United States, they're subsidizing the fuel oil consumption of poor U.S. citizens, right? South Bronx, yeah, in certain parts of the United States, and this is probably like the same thing, you know, providing subsidized credit to the poor that are coming from the resources that come out of the oil resources of Venezuela. So, in a sense, what you have to explain is why does it contradict the domestic policies, right, of Peru, right? What's wrong with resources from abroad being used to subsidize the requirements of the poor in your country, right? Do they violate any of the banking laws? Do they violate any of your laws, right? These houses of Alba. In effect, in the U.S., it was completely just an embarrassment, right? That the governments here could not even provide subsidized fuel. I mean, heating for poor residents in New York.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I'm still really wondering the extent of the effect of this crisis on sub-Saharan African countries. I don't know, has there been some kind of systematic study done, you know, to really evaluate the impact of this crisis, or is it, you know, like general observations or whatever? Because the reason I'm saying this is that most of our countries really, they were not really exporting that much. Yeah. They had maybe like one or two export crops, and in terms of the domestic economy, you find they have a large subsistence economy. You know, people are producing most of the stuff that they eat, you know, not much by way of exchange. Actually, in the village, someone can just get food from his garden and eat for the entire week without really bothering to go to the shop. But maybe that's an extreme in the case of Uganda, because our soil is reasonably fertile, and a big part of it is arable land. But I'm really, you know, just trying to figure out, because most of our exports these days, or in the past 2-3 years, have really the regional trade has really increased. We are exporting, because we produce food, you know, I think in the five countries of the East African region, we seem to be having more food than the rest. So we are exporting foodstuffs to the rest of these countries. But also because we are sort of in the middle of Kenya and Sudan, Southern Sudan, Rwanda, and Burundi, we import things from Kenya and then we export. You know, we are sort of, you know, like a gateway, some kind of, you know. So I am really trying to figure out the real impact of this. And if a study has not really been carried out, I feel this would be a very important area to do.
Well, and I never presented this. These are forecasts for growth rates, right? But it will also depend on each country. But the way developing countries are going to be affected is as we discussed last night, is number one is if you're a commodity exporter, a lot of the poor countries are actually commodity exporters. They export oil. Now those prices will go down. When those prices go down, public revenues of the government do go down, and that means they have to cut. They have to cut expenditures, or they have to figure out, you know, like what to do with the money, right? I mean, should they print money? I mean, they can. If you believe Randy Ray, they can float their exchange rate and start printing money, right? So if you're a commodity exporter, that's the first thing. If you're an exporter of manufactured goods, that's also going to impact you because the markets in the United States, et cetera, are gone, right? So all export industries are going to be badly affected, right? Now, in some countries, agriculture is still in good shape, right? And in a sense, as long as, and you know, it depends on the country, but in some countries, agriculture is in good shape. People can be sent to the agricultural area, and that can provide, absorb some of that labor, right? But in other countries, that's not true. And I think in Africa, probably agriculture was it's not in good shape, but in such a poor state, right, that it couldn't get any worse, right? It wasn't as if it was being destroyed. In a very large way by neoliberal economics, but it was just that there was no investment. There was insufficient investment in these places. But there is enough. I mean, African density, land density is not very high. There's enough ability to absorb people into the rural areas. But it all depends on the way in which the countries are actually mostly direct involved with the international system, right? And you know, I mean, as you say, you're based on trade, right? And Sudan exports oil. To the extent that Sudan does not stops growing, then you would be affected by the fact that Sudan that oil prices have gone down drastically. So you don't see it yet.